Welcome to Coaching Uncaged by Animas, the podcast that explores the art, science, and career of coaching. And now, introducing your host and interviewer, Yannick Jacob.
Tatiana Bakirova, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Nice to see you, Yannick.
Yes, it's so nice to spend time with you. I feel quite privileged to be in this position to speak with all these amazing people. And your name has definitely popped up more times than I can think that far. But, you know, as an evidence-based kind of coach, having gone through training and reading quite a lot of the literature, there's just absolutely no way around you. And I like to introduce people that way, right? Because you're such a thinker. I've heard someone refer to you as a wisdom weaver, and I loved that.
Right. Okay. We should start from the point that I think it's such a strange title. from the US side, they are very generous usually with all this wonderful thing.
Well, factually, you're a professor of coaching psychology at Oxford Brookes. You're teaching on the MA in coaching and mentoring practice there. You've also program-led the advanced study in coaching supervision. So there's a lot of research that you've put up. I think the last count that I had was over 70 articles, book chapters. You published 4 books, amongst them, developmental coaching, working with the self, which I found really interesting. There's a couple of edited books as well. So you really bring a lot of people together. I really enjoyed some of your publications in the Philosophy of Coaching, a really good free journal, by the way, for anybody out there who enjoys deep thinking. And you put some really interesting ideas out there, and you review the literature, you look at what's happening in what people are researching, and how can we grasp what coaching is, what supervision is, and how can we, you know, be better coaches, essentially. And I think on that part, we're quite aligned. You're also quite a critical thinker, right? So I really enjoy that about you. I have a couple of gripes because, you know, we were going to talk about it a little more because there was one particular article beautifully entitled Beautiful Ideas That Can Make Us Ill. You wrote that with a colleague of yours. I forgot his name now. Who was it?
Simon Borrington.
Simon Borrington, of course. You're particularly critical about positive psychology, about transformation and transformational coaching, about mindfulness. So just some examples of there's something that gets accepted by many coaches as something very beautiful and often a panacea for helping people. And it's got hailed a lot. And it was important to you that you put a critical perspective out there. We had Simon Weston on the podcast as well. So he's also quite a critical thinker. And I heard a conversation between the two of you where, you know, you really got into, what's that about? But I just wanted to put that out there before we get into the details and allow me to challenge you on some of that, that this is a really important perspective. And especially in coaching, I feel we need more critical thinkers. And coming from a research-informed and evidence-based perspective, I think it's a really good way to create some debate. And so that's why I really look forward to having you on today. And I think we both want to encourage coaches out there to think a bit more critically about what it is they do and how they do it.
That's a good intention. I agree. And just to say from the very beginning, it's not that I'm critical about everything in terms of all these beautiful ideas. And I really always want to specify that I am for the science of positive psychology. I do recognize the value of the transformative learning, of course, in education and in any other fields. I'm thinking that sometimes when we are taking it without challenge, without sort of looking at all the nuances and consequences, then we are in trouble. So, and I want us to pay attention to those troubles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good. Well, let's get into some of those troubles. I mean, I've already kind of set this up. My background is in positive psychology. I kind of fell into positive psychology when I was at university, because I was lucky enough that one of the second masters was just there in front of me, and I could just say yes to it. So that's how I discovered coaching. And as you also write, a lot of the science coming from the branch of science that is positive psychology is very, very valuable to coaches. You know, studying optimal human functioning, studying what's right with people, positive emotions, optimism. You know, there's also a branch that is more about, well, positive reframing. Optimism is a style of positive thinking, if you will. But then it gets morphed very quickly, especially in the media, into something that is like a panacea for everything. So I'd love to hear a little bit more about how that paper came to be. And then maybe you can kind of lay out the argument a little bit, and then maybe we can have a conversation about why this is relevant to coaches. So I guess I wanted to start with the title, because it's a bit provocative, right? It certainly generated immediate attention and people still talking about it. How come that title, and what is it about?
Okay. It's a good point to start from it. I agree, because it's something about us as coaches. Because I actually think we are quite an excitable bunch. Okay? We really like learning about things, and it's good because we sort of do what we preach with our clients. We help them to become better. For that reason, we are quite sensitized to new ideas. We want to learn. And also, one of the unfortunate features of our field, I believe, is because it's sort of merging now with marketing, okay? Because it's not only what we learn, we also want to sell that. Mm-hmm. And we sell sometimes sort of quite efficiently. So what I was trying to make clear, sort of, we do fall for interesting ideas, and mm-hmm. we want to use them. That's why I call them beautiful ideas. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's like overplaying the strengths, if we use the positive psychology mm-hmm. terminology. So I think these strengths are overplayed quite significantly in coaches. And that's what I wanted to put the little subtitles mm-hmm. that can make us ill. There are negative consequences, and we need to be aware of them if we are taking this idea uncritically.
Yeah. And maybe let's start with transformational coaching, which you name specifically. And obviously, as I mentioned in the couple of minutes before we met, you know, this is a podcast of a school for transformative coaching. And people who listen to the podcast for a while, especially the episode with Nick Bolton, the founder, he's moved away from transformational coaching to transformative coaching, because mm-hmm. he's also had a gripe with, oh, transformation could really be anything to anybody, it seems. And there's such a huge range, and also mm-hmm. there's some negative connotations to it. But I think mainly for him, it was more the grounding in the literature, the grounding in theory. I mean, we're standing on the shoulders of giants. The, you know, Jack Meserov's transformative learning theory was particularly inspiring. And so there is a lot on transformation, but it has become something odd and something that puts a lot of pressure on people. And I think that's from reading the paper, that seems to be your main critique of transformational coaching. What else is there? Do you want to speak into that space a bit?
Of course, yes. And it's fair enough to start from it, because I'm kind of critical practically everywhere about that. And but I just want to start from clarifying, I'm not against the idea of transformation, mm-hmm. clearly. Okay? And I strongly believe that transformation happens. But there are lots of, and I will be sort of, my critique will be mainly still about transformational coaching as an approach or mm-hmm. as something that people sell, okay, offer to clients. the transformative shift may be quite clever, but let's look at that. three points probably worth mentioning. First, which what I probably would agree with your founder, with Nick, that it's conceptually quite weak idea. Okay? Mm-hmm. And I think it's sort of, and not that unique if you actually think about that. Okay, because strictly speaking, if you understand it in the way that traditionally, and it started from Peter Hawkins, and is that you understand transformation as shift in your beliefs or in your assumptions, in your thinking, it's just a cognitive thing, okay? So what I'm saying, how is it different from CBT or NLP or whatever other approaches who also try to make that, okay? So if you go slightly further, when they talk conceptually, it's a jump from the some stage of adult development to another stage of adult development. Mm-hmm. I would say that is the huge claim. And if you look at the original theorist of all these adult development theories, they never advocate that it can happen in the room. And it's actually some explicitly warn that it shouldn't be treated like that, because otherwise it sort of implies that there is, it's such a simple thing that could be done. Mm-hmm. And will, okay, and create other negative consequences. So what I'm saying, it is conceptually vague, okay, or not that unique if you actually see it as a sort of specific approach, okay. So, but also what I'm really don't okay. I said the first feature is the conceptual weak. Let me name them first. The mm-hmm. first one is the conceptual weakness. Then I strangely would argue that it is the very coach-oriented approach.
A coach-oriented approach?
Coach-oriented approach, yes. And I will make a case on that. Mm-hmm. And the third point would be actually some very serious negative consequences. And mm-hmm. I will talk a little bit more about that, because I didn't have that space. We didn't have that space in the paper to discuss.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of the vagueness of the concept, what it actually allows, and this is what I'm worried about, is overselling it, overpromising. Okay? And that is, I say everywhere, yes, transformation happens, but you can't promise it, okay?
Oh, yeah.
And why it is important that you can't promise it, it means that it might be actually unethical to promise something that you can't mm-hmm. deliver. Okay? Mm-hmm. Because if you look at what psychologists now allowed to promise, right? And because they are chartered and sort of with all the ethical expectations, they only say we work with something. Okay, we right. don't heal, we don't yeah. cure, we don't do that. So they don't give any promise. So I'm specializing in working with people, let's say with depression or OCD, or I'm working with people who are, let's say, in occupational psychology, who are going through transition, okay? But they yeah. won't tell you that you will be successful. Okay?
Yeah. Can I jump in there with something? Because I wonder how that's different to, for example, a transition coach or a weight loss coach or a stress reduction coach or whatever other coach there is. It seems that it implies a promise that this is going to happen. There's never a promise. We only can ever sell the potential, can we?
I think it's absolutely right. But I think the nuance of transformation is a little bit stronger than the nuance of, let's say, presentation, or how you call the coaches, performance coaches. Okay. So, because can you say performance? It just means that. I will improve performance.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, you can't promise that either. It takes the client to improve their performance, right?
Speaking, you are right. Yeah, maybe that's also not shouldn't be promised. Yeah, transformation, it's a too big a thing to promise, is it?
Yeah, I think when somebody calls herself a transformational coach, I think it's the same as if somebody says I'm a performance coach. They both sell the potential of increased performance or transformation. I do very much agree that many transformational coaches, in the way that they sell it, oversell that potential. You know, it kind of sounds like a very early business mentor once told me, Yannick, you need to have more certainty when in your consultations, you know, and I'm like, well, I'm an existentialist. How can I have certainty about anything? I mean, there's no certainty, certainly not when I sell something, because it's a relationship. You know, we both have to work, and I can do my best work and transformation still isn't going to happen, or insights are still not going to happen, or learning or performance or whatever other word I put ahead of my coaching.
Oh, maybe you are right. Absolutely. Maybe in this case, we should actually avoid any of these titles. We should call them ourselves organizational coaches if we work in organizations, or
life coaches, I guess.
Life coaches, yeah, because it's you work with life problems. So that would be more cleaner approach.
Yeah, but it does sell a lot less. It's true, you know.
But that doesn't sell, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's continue. You said something about it being unique, right? And not being particularly unique. Yeah, it's interesting, because the way my framework for transformative coaching or any sort of coaching really is integrating a lot of other tools and approaches within that relationship. So when I think transformation, I think, well, if there's an adult, like a new phase that somebody's entering, or if there's a profound paradigm shift that somebody's reaching, I do very much agree that, you know, if we aim for that, maybe that's a big goal, and maybe that will never happen. Often that happens after the coaching, or maybe just naturally, or maybe when the person sits in the car, you know, on their way to work 2 weeks later. But I do think we can create the conditions for that to be more likely, or maybe accelerated through raising some sort of awareness or challenging existing paradigms.
What would help me, actually, because I want to understand it also more, how you made that change. Okay, how do you define the transformation?
Yeah, so for me, it's a significant paradigm shift, right? I started thinking, well, what's the difference between transformation and change? And it seems that a lot of transformational coaches, a lot of coaches who work towards transformation, they see it as a deep, profound change. You know, it's just not just change. Some sort of behavior change is not quite transformation. But that underlying that is a significant paradigm shift that that creates a change that leaves who we were before behind. We're working with a self in many ways, right? We are self as being something that is underlined by certain paradigms and certain worldviews, beliefs, and some of them are more core than others. So if we shift some of those, I think there's a new form that emerges.
Yeah, it sounds, I can kind of sympathize, because there is the issue, what sort of words we use to describe something, because quite often it becomes cliche, and then it's a kind of, you don't want to hear that. If you go into the more like academic level, for example, what you would say to your client if you actually say, we want to shift the paradigm for you? Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, of course.
I don't see it. It's really, that's what I call, in terms of vagueness, one of the most concrete things people say in terms of shifting paradigm, which I think is an interesting way to put it, is actually simply change your beliefs from one to another, okay, to challenge the assumptions, and that assumptions has been kind of changed. But that sounds for me quite a cognitive thing still, isn't it?
I see that it often happens on a cognitive level, but I think if it all stays there, and if it's not embodied, if it's not lived, you know, if it's not connected to how you show up, then it may not last as long, or it may feel incomplete. Yeah. But I do think that if we shift thinking, then often the embodied experience will follow. It's a bit like in cognitive behavioral work, you can start with the embodiment, you can start with somatic work, and that will shift your thinking. You can start with behavior and that will shift your thinking or how you feel about certain things. I do think we can tackle transformation in many different starting points.
Yeah. And in this sense, that's why I say it's not that unique, because cognitive behavior coaching also tries to do the same thing. Okay.
I don't see them as separate.
Yeah, not that separate. That's what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And I'm not saying that it's not possible, again, because these shifts are happening and people do see things in a different light. I don't always see that understanding or insight actually changing behavior because it's kind of wishful thinking. Sometimes it's even unfortunate things, because we as coaches want it so much. Okay, we just help the client to change the language about that, and they start talking in a different way and think that the big change has happened.
Fake it till you make it, huh?
And no, it's just because they want to please us, or they want actually also feel that they succeeded in this big shift, big transformation.
Because you set that up with a word. Like if you set it up in the context of transformational coaching, then the client will play along and, you know.
Exactly. But one of the negative consequences there, it's not that they might actually fake it. It's actually, right, if you learn that language, it's good. But if I haven't, I failed.
Yeah. But again, wouldn't that be the same in performance coaching or behavioral coaching if somebody fails to establish a new habit?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think so. But kind of that in this sense, I'm saying there is not a particular uniqueness there. Okay.
Because yeah.
The failure in this regard is attributed to any type of coaching.
Yeah, I think it's a general problem with coaching that is very goal-oriented and results-oriented, no?
Yeah. But the bigger things, and this is what I think it's an issue, it's that it's a coach-oriented approach, as well as NLP, as well as cognitive behavior type of coaching. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And why I'm saying that, because if you actually read carefully that material on transformational coaching, that's my, okay. I don't know the nuances yet of transformative, what you call. So when you read the transformational, it comes across very strongly, it's the coach who is the magician. Okay?
Oh.
It's the coach who knows whether transformation is needed or not. It's a coach who actually can predict what needs to be worked on and what this big shift needs to happen in the room. Okay. So, and this is, I would say, it's not actually very much in the spirit of coaching as we advocated.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I would very much agree with that. I think there's a lot of ego involved if you think that you can change someone else. I mean, yes, you can put some ideas on the table or some powerful questions, as many people love to call them. But like, really, it's a relationship-based activity. And I see so many coaches in supervision working much harder than their clients. And it leads to all sorts of issues.
Yeah, exactly. And that's also what accentuated is the actual thing that you can create that shift in the room. If you didn't, you are also no good as a coach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is there more around transformational coaching that you still wanted to put out there? Because I'd be quite happy to move into positive psychology, if that's okay with you. Or is there something that you, I mean, a lot of transformational coaches will be listening to this, right? And I wonder how they feel at the moment. And I wonder if there's something else you might want to tell them.
I tend to be sometimes a bit radical. So for example, I wouldn't call my coaching transformational, okay, to start with.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, and you made the good argument that it might be always some sort of, it's not a promise, it's something like a potential. I go along with this argument. But I would just simply put, well, there is now a tendency to call it relational as well,
mm-hmm.
which also can go slightly far with the notion that it's all it's not me as a coach, like that magician. It's our relationship that make it work. Okay, and then you will focus only on relationship, which also probably not a productive approach. Okay, I would sort of see. Tend to see things in a much simpler way, okay? But not as simple probably. If you read Stacy, for example, looks at all the things that we do, including the work as coaches in the complexity terms. But strangely enough, his final conclusion was what we do, what we only can do is to think together with the client about what is important to them.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what kind of where I would go with that kind of minimizing the promise, but seeing coaching as an inquiry, as a joint inquiry, not just a relationship and to be nice to each other, okay? A joint inquiry and thinking together about things that are important to the client.
Yeah, I guess if I put myself into the shoes of a coach that's starting out. I mean, I talked to quite a lot of them. I'm sure you do too. There is a marketing element to this that is difficult to ignore because if you're able to portray coaching as what it is, then I think a lot of people just wouldn't really be that interested in it. So I get why coaches start talking about transformation and the change that could be perceived and, you know, what is the problem you're solving or what's the desire that you're creating a space for the potential of achieving. You know, if I get why coaches start talking about it from this angle, is there a solution to this? Because it seems a dilemma, right? Are we over-promising? Are we making it clear that it's potential, but then the people who are over-promising get the conversations?
I think you are absolutely highlighting what I would call the tragedy of coaching. And I don't think that's the problem. It's the way we became successful, and what I mean by as a field, okay, we became accepted on the organizational levels. People are buying coaches, to use coaching, because it started from believing in all these wonderful things that they can happen. Okay? And coaches became good at promising. But can you see, I don't think we can jump sort of from that tendency so quickly, right? Because we need to develop good reputation. And at the moment, the reputation is only built on those kind of promises. Right? But if you look, for example, how serious fields, and I would call that like established, long-term established fields, how they treat coaching, they treat it with huge suspicion exactly because of this tendency to overpromise or oversell.
I thought I was seeing the trend. Maybe you see a different trend, that coaching becomes more accepted and that coaching has evolved from something that is purely behavior change oriented and performance boost oriented. It evolved more into something that's much more inspired by creating therapeutic conditions, core conditions, for example. I mean, Reinhard Stelter, you mentioned Hahn, the German philosopher, German-Korean, I think, that the Burnout Society really inspired, and Reinhard Stelter as well, who we had on the podcast, the next generation of coaching, the third generation of, you know, lingering with a client, being with, you know, my field, existential coaching. There's a lot of emphasis on sitting down with someone, paying attention to what's in front of us, paying attention to relationship dynamics, but, you know, going with the client and letting them very much take the lead. There isn't this over-promising and solution focus. So I see a lot of coaching having evolved, creating a systemic lens. The boundaries get blurrier, which in itself brings lots of concerns. But to me, it seems that coaching has evolved into something that is much more grounded and much more acceptable and much more accepted. But what you're saying points in towards a different direction, that there's still a lot of suspicion and it seems to be growing.
Right. And I'm talking here as an academic. And I also can see that shift in coaches. Okay, I definitely see the changes that people started understanding. They become more critical. They become more, I would say, developmentally much more kind of advanced coaches. So I agree with your description of this tendency. But the tendency to sell didn't disappear. Mm-hmm. We still are. Can you see there is no community of coaches? Okay. Everyone is for themselves, because it's, and that is an interesting feature of our field as well, because it's very difficult to create something together to agree, okay? Because everyone needs to deal with their own business. That is what typically happens. Yeah. And in education, we have only such small groups of people who focus in on coaching, because it also doesn't pay. The business schools, if you look at that, so they are not that supportive. The psychology schools also not that supportive. That's why I'm talking about that. I'm saying that we do need to recognize how we are seen.
Mm-hmm.
Probably much better seen now by the clients. We have more self-respect for ourselves, mm-hmm. As coaches, but the reputation is still not that kind of, doesn't follow that yet.
Yeah. Makes me think about consultants, who in many ways, there's a lot of parallels with how it came up, because a lot of consultants needed to create their own business. And now we have, four huge consultancies that operate globally, that hire all of these consultants. Coaching kind of found a way into that, but what my experience is, what is being sold as coaching within those consultancy packages is often very far from what I would consider coaching. But I wonder if where the future of selling coaching is going. Could it be as might we have 4 big consultancies or 3 or whatever number that just kind of bring coaches together? Or how can we solve this?
That's a big thing. I don't know. I don't have an answer to that, Yannick, unfortunately, because I think, and it's a good analogy with consultancy, okay? And we might think that it could go that way, but I would worry about that too.
Yeah.
Because one of the unique feature of coaching, and that's why I support it 100% with all my heart and will continue, okay? Until I can, because it has, it is this unique opportunity to work individually with clients, okay? To work exactly on their needs, to work with their uniqueness, okay? To see things, help them to see more within themselves, with the wider world, okay? That's not what consultancy also about. Okay? The consultancy is based on the expertise on the consultant. Okay? So what I'm saying, our similarity in this regard with therapy or counseling is also a unique feature, which is good. We should sort of recognize it and value it and whatever theoretically comes from it.
Yeah.
So I don't know the answer yet. Okay. I still hope that maybe gradually by developing ourselves as coaches, we might find some more kind of honest, more explicitly non-selling way or more honest way. Yeah, I would say of, and maybe the clientele will become more also educated, more understanding about the nuances and what the differences between the consultancy and therapy and coaching.
Yeah. For me, I think it has to be somehow grounded in the relationships we're building, and that we build relationships not through coaching or when we start coaching, but that we build a relationship, and within that relationship, we can maybe offer coaching. Because once we create a relationship where someone trusts us as a human being, you know, that they've met. He is somebody that seemed to, you know, think well and, you know, be trustworthy. Mm-hmm. And if within that space we can offer coaching and not having to oversell it because we already have the relationship, yes. I can really only see it go that way.
Yeah, and this is exactly the way of to work with. So what we are discussing right now, as I understand, is sort of how to make it work in terms of the image of coaching.
Mm-hmm.
Because I kind of believe that when clients are in the room, they do it trying to do the best for their, the coaches are in the room, they're trying to do the best for their clients.
Mm-hmm.
It's what is happening before that. It's the industry behind coaching that
mm-hmm.
That needs some shifts. And for that reason, we probably need to forget that, should not forget that we have another function as coaches, okay? Which is, I would call educational,
mm-hmm.
is to work with our sponsors, with organizations, with HR people, what real coaching is about.
Mm. Yeah, and especially at kind of high levels of credentialing, there is a written competence that, you know, we have a responsibility towards the coaching industry. And I think that's something we should take very seriously. And I really appreciate the work of the professional bodies in that direction.
Yes, yeah. And the professional bodies also play a huge mm-hmm. role.
Yeah. Well, let's dig into positive psychology a little bit before I'd love to know. Yeah. Well, before I ask you more questions, when I've listened to this, both your conversation with Simon, the article that you've written, I got this sense that, you know, while you make it very clear that positive psychology has a lot to offer and that you're not bashing the idea, you're just kind of highlighting where this could go wrong. It had this air of being quite simplified, you know, because I see positive psychology as quite a broad field of study of what's right with people, and mentioned a few things earlier. And often it always bugs me when it gets portrayed as positive thinking, you know, and I think there's so much more to the positive thinking and positive reframing and happy people make more money, you know, and part of the, what I read it as part of the main kind of critique was, there is this air of positive psychology as making people more productive by just putting the personal responsibility of well-being onto the individual, and that there's systemic issues that we need to address. And I think that's very important. But this, it seemed kind of oversimplified as putting positive psychology as positive thinking. And I think the argument that it's being sold to organizations to, I think it's because of what organizations respond to, that this is being sold in that way, when actually positive psychology has so much more to offer just as a research agenda.
Mm. Okay, and I'm very much open to you persuading me that it's not the case.
It's not my job here. Although part of me wants to, I noticed that part.
I'm happy to change my mind, but and you are right, as I said, I support some parts of positive psychology as a field of knowledge, okay? Probably the whole field of knowledge, because we need to learn more, and it's an interesting alternative, interesting way of looking at how people function. So I'm 100% for that. Okay, I also like some features of positive psychology as a coaching approach, which is, in my view, it's a sort of intention to empower the clients, which is actually, in my view, is missing in transformational coaching.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, actually, it's worth saying something about that because because one of the sort of like a core word that in transformational coaching people use, it's a quote from Marshall Goldsmith. They're saying, "What got you here won't got you there." Okay, it's a And I'm just thinking, this is really disempowering statement. This is actually saying, I'm as a coach, I know that whatever you learned before is actually no good. You need to be different. So this is what I don't like. Okay, and positive psychology doesn't fall into that error, I would say. They do want to say that what you develop is your strengths, is your ability, is something you can build on and use further. So it's kind of focusing on the power of the client rather than you knowing how things need to be magically transformed. Sorry, I'm exaggerating a little bit. So that is good thing. I also like this as an approach of working with particular issues and with particular clients, okay? Mm-hmm. So for example, if it is the issues of well-being, okay, I think it's a very good way of working with clients. Okay? Mm-hmm. Also, if the clients are on what I call the unformed stage, okay, where there is a lot of doubts and the need for belonging and the needs of kind of to come to your strength, okay, that's also a good approach. For other clients, it may not be that good. Okay. Mm-hmm. So now, saying that I acknowledge positive things, what is the negative? It's probably my, and it's a personal approach for where the learning comes from. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. But first, I would want to say what I don't like about positive psychology, if it's presented as an ideology, what I call it.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's the only way how coaches should approach. So I don't like that. Okay. Yeah. And some people were actually arguing that the whole coaching is based only or theoretically underpinned only by positive psychology.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So, but in terms of my personal sort of issue with that, and I understand that I might be simplifying, but I kind of talked a lot with positive psychologists and read a lot, so I think I do have some grasp of it. So it's actually where the learning comes from, right? Because I personally believe that the learning doesn't come from being happy, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The learning comes from discontent,
mm-hmm.
okay? So that's a kind of principle thing, okay? It just simply say where we start from, okay? It's where we are going with that. I feel that, and I already said, that coaching is an inquiry. So it actually have to have a question for the client that is based on something they are not happy with. Okay? So I have some sort of way of thinking how to deal with that, but I recognize that it doesn't work and I don't know what to do about it. So it's a negative thing, okay?
Yeah.
I'm okay with that.
Yeah, so the motivation for learning often springs from discontent. And I think we see that in reality when people seek learning spaces when something isn't going well. I don't think that excludes that a lot of learning can come from seekers, or like the kind of difference between hunger, which comes from a lack, and drive, which comes from a desire to grow and expand. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a lot we can learn. I think it's very much right that often the stronger motivation to learn comes from when things go wrong and figuring things out and how does this work? How does that make sense? But I think in the spirit of in the original argument of why positive psychology is important, it's not that that should be replaced by only learning from positivity or from what things are already going well, but that's kind of missing in learning spaces, the exploration of what's already going well. I do think we very much need both. And I think in many places, the focus on what's already going well is underrepresented or is not really being utilized.
Right. Let me just check if I understand you correctly. Okay. Sort of you recognize that often learning comes from the what I call the negative place. Okay?
100%, yeah.
Right. But you say that in positive psychology, focusing on what is going well already is still justified.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. I mean, appreciative inquiry is used to great success, mm-hmm. you know, because that's an inquiry that often isn't really taking place. When I meet a coach in supervision, mm-hmm. I often ask them, you know, tell me about a time you've done your best coaching. You know, tell me about a session that went really, really well. What can you learn from that? And that's a question often we don't ask ourselves. And
so
I think
what
that's
is the purpose
missing out. Well, I think we're missing out on a whole lot of learning when we only inquire when things go wrong. Because the underlying argument of positive psychology is if we bring everything back to zero that is in the negative, we're missing out on the 0 to +10 range.
Right. Okay. So what you are saying that it is quite justified to start, even if the person has the inquiry, in my view, that is based on disequilibrium, that something doesn't work, okay, you still go straight away into thinking, yeah, let's think about something what you actually do well, what are your strengths, what have you learned before, so you feel that it's completely justified.
I think it's more complex than that. I have on occasion invited a client to, for the moment, you know, leave all of that what's wrong behind and just for some time inquire on what's already going well. And sometimes that has resolved the issue. Because by thinking about how one do I want things to be or what can I already build on, what strength can I build on, for example, sometimes the issue just disappears in the process of that kind of line of inquiry. Whereas if we would have, I don't know, because you never know what would have happened if you've done something instead. But I've spent quite some time with some clients exploring the negative and exploring the problem and analyzing it. And, you know, and it didn't really go anywhere. And then the positive path has really opened up a different kind of thinking. So I can see that work. I think we can't ignore it. And I think problem-focused coaching has a place that is of super high value. It really depends on the context. Sometimes somebody is stuck in a line of inquiry that isn't helpful. So opening up a different line of inquiry can be just what they needed to unlock a different path.
Okay, maybe sometimes it is useful. Yeah, like I can imagine that if sort of you feel that the person is already stuck and you don't have any kind of interesting way to push your inquiry into the actual problem. Because for me, by the way, the problem, it's not just what you start from. You actually understand the situation much better. To understand the problem, it's already partially a way of sorting it. Okay, so that's why I also not agree with how in positive psychology is sometimes treated. But you are saying that if it doesn't go anywhere, then thinking using positive things as an alternative way, as a potential new perspective on things might be useful.
I think I would go even further that I've had some great success starting from that position. And it's not my modus operandi now, but I mean, I've spent a lot of time with a lot of positive psychology coaches and I've experimented with a lot of these approaches myself. And that sometimes we really don't need to get into the problem, even though they're presenting with a problem. And that focusing on what's right and what's going well can actually resolve that without focusing on it because things start moving. I don't think that we can use it as a panacea. And I mean, part of the reason why I moved away from positive psychology was that a lot of my colleagues were way too positive about things and took this as an ideology that should always be applied no matter what. They're strength-based coaches that would always start with exploring strength. And I think that has value because we get to know a person's values and belief system by exploring their strength. And it's a wonderful way to start a relationship. It's a wonderful way to create some positive emotions. They broaden thought action repertoires, according to Fredrickson. And, you know, it's setting up the atmosphere for coaching engagement. Doesn't mean that you then don't start focusing on the problem if that's what's needed, you know, but it's just something that offers a lot to coaches, I think, but can't be used in isolation on its own.
Yeah. Okay. What you just said, it's actually hinting on the mechanism because that's what I was interested in. What does it, apart from just being one other trick out of your tool bag, what is it actually for when you focus on strengths when the actual sort of problem is in front of you?
Yeah, well, it depends on the problem, right? I think it always depends on what is the client presenting with. And if, for example, they feel disengaged at work, let's say, you know, maybe they lost their mojo or like they started procrastinating about things, whatever problem focused way you could present that as.
Okay. And that's what you said where you were hinting on the mechanisms. You were just saying you actually help the client to think better about themselves and their ability to think about it by focusing on something that they've done before well, or mm-hmm. they have a particular capacity. Okay, there is a mechanism there, I can see that. I still can see that it's slightly, okay, for me personally, it would be very awkward to use.
Well, it needs to be authentic, right?
Yeah, exactly. Because I just see it's a little bit manipulative in some respect. Okay. And also, and that's what I call it, slightly out of the bag. Okay, I know that it works and I will try it on you, even when you are here to think about something else.
But then it becomes a trick or something from your toolbox. For me, it has become a lens through which I see people and relationships and myself, right? I'd be authentically, genuinely curious about that person at their best. You know, I'd be really curious, and it's not a trick. It feels like a natural inquiry to me about, you know, who are you and what's right with you? And I think it has a lot to offer, but I totally agree that if that's not your style, and, you know, then I don't think when we use it, it will feel like a trick and a technique that we apply to someone. And then becomes quite formulaic, no?
Yeah, no, I don't doubt you being genuine about that. I just imagine myself working with you and saying, why do you need to know? I hired you to help with this.
I would totally go with where you lead. Because I think this is, you know, it's funny, but also it's very an important point, I think, for coaches. When, you know, when you co-create a relationship, you can offer what you're curious about. But if that person is not curious about what you're curious about, then I think we need to go with them and where they lead. And I heard you once say in a podcast that, well, if they don't like my style, then what was it? If they don't like my style, then they can't work with me or something like that. If you want to work with me, you have to accept my style. And it kind of came out of you. I think you talked, I think the question was around coaching some world leaders currently. And, you know, you bring a particular style to the coaching relationship, and somebody with a very strong positive psychology lens would bring their style of coaching to the relationship. So I think there's something quite important there, is that, you know, not every coach is going to work effectively with every other client. I think there needs to be some alignment in terms of how we're going to work together in this space.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very good point. And I'm very much for the diversity of coaches. Okay? Mm-hmm. I think in our programs, we actually teach not one particular approach at all. That's, by the way, my disagreement with some programs that actually say this is the way to coach. We just say to people, this is the whole spectrum of thing, okay, mm-hmm. that coaches might use. But the most important is for you to understand yourself and to find your unique style.
Absolutely. Much more difficult to teach. There's a lot of people who are just tell me how it's done.
Exactly.
And a lot of coaching schools are happy to oblige.
But in terms of kind of agreeing with you, and I do remember I actually said from the very beginning, it simply probably clashes with me, because people who want to work with me, they will know that I'm not that happiness spreader. Okay. And it's my style would be slightly different. So that's why, but those who for whom it would be very important to start from recognizing their strengths and focusing on positive, they probably would go to the positive psychologist.
Mm-hmm. And I think this is where you resonate with particular coaches. And I think that's why we're back at marketing, right? How can you, without over-promising, how can you expose your theoretical and philosophical lens so that people might resonate with that?
Yeah. You know? The only warning I probably will offer in still, okay, including, by the way, my approach, that it might not be always, it's a kind of focusing yourself too narrowly mm-hmm. is might be not a good idea, because clients are different, issues are different, much more complex than they are, than we can imagine them.
Yeah.
And one more talking about the complexity, okay? And this is why I think the positive psychology might be improved, okay? Positive psychology approach, I would say, mm-hmm. because I think focusing on what is happening within the client is not a bad idea. And I always say you can go in depth within, but you also need to see the picture much wider. Mm-hmm. And I, again, now I'm bringing my sort of critical view. There is so much to say that is happening wrong in the context of our clients. So, mm-hmm. and putting the responsibility of them changing only things within themselves, okay, mm-hmm. is not the right way. Yeah. Even if it's done in a positive way with good intention mm-hmm. to keep clients or thinking about clients' well-being, because I think this is, that needs to be to show in terms of Han and burnout society with this idea. So I'm just, this is significantly wrong. And I think it's part of our duty to bring that into sessions, even if it sounds quite negative.
Yeah, absolutely. There's very little time and quite a few things I still wanted to ask you. I'm just trying to think what might be a good direction. One question that kind of floated around in the middle of this, and I'd love to offer you a space to kind of talk specifically about that, because I know you wrote about it, is coach education. You touched on it a bunch of times. It's too insular, it's too formulaic. What needs to change? And is there even a realistic possibility that it will? I mean, we can only encourage coaching training providers out there to maybe do things differently, but what would be your advice or your wish for coaching education going forward?
Oh, that's a huge topic.
I know.
And I probably, as usually, will have to start what's wrong with that now. And I think one of the wrong things is we are following the lead of the professional bodies, which are doing the right thing in this regard. But if we actually follow in their only need to judge everything in terms of competences, we are already not doing our job as educators in the wider sense of the meaning of this word of education. So that's what's wrong. And I think now, because coaches really want everything to be accredited, educational providers, they just try to squeeze everything what is required for this accreditation. Mm-hmm. I think, and by the way, us including, we feel that it is a pressure, it's huge pressure, because that's what customers ask, right? Mm-hmm. And we are not able to be reasonably or really independent that as education should be. Mm-hmm. And we need to grow awareness of future coaches that there is a difference between training and the education. And that's what, and also in terms of the education as such, one of the things that you already said, and it's incredibly valuable to have it evidence-based, to develop research, to introduce every new knowledge that develops in the field and new conceptual thinking. So that is what needs to inform our programs. Mm-hmm. But what is kind of my issue right now, and you probably sense this through all this conversation, is what is missing for me, hugely missing, it's the critical stance. Mm-hmm. And it's missing in education, it's missing in coaches, unfortunately, sometimes. And this is what I kind of personally want to devote my time to right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Although it's not easy. It's not.
Yeah. Well, that's sometimes you don't make friends when you're being critical. I just moved to Germany recently from the UK, and I find it uncomfortable, and I value it hugely that a lot more people, especially in Berlin, just tell you outright what they think and what they didn't like. You know, I think that's great. And sometimes I pause and I'm like, And then I wonder, who else didn't tell me what they think just to keep things comfortable? And I think that's hugely valuable for coaches, because I also see a lot of coaches in supervision hesitant to challenge and hesitant to confront and hesitant to create, to be critical, right? Being critical has had this negative flair to it, especially in the UK. And that's a trend I'd love to counter, but it's difficult because it seems so ingrained in the culture.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is why it's difficult, because you kind of, it's assumed that you are critical of the person. And that is not necessarily the case. So in my case, I genuinely care about this field. But I believe that if you don't name what's wrong, you can't improve it.
Mm-hmm. And I think if you don't name what's wrong, then how much do you really care about the field?
Exactly.
Just as we're kind of slowly closing, I know you've done a lot of research, especially into coaching supervision recently. So I wonder if there's a piece of research, a study, a recent insight that you've got from the evidence that's out there, either something you've researched or something you've come across. Is there something that is of interest, of value to coaches or supervisors out there that you could share with us?
I won't mention my own research, actually, because I just recently reread the article, which I was a reviewer for, and it is published in quite high level 4-star journal, and it's about the neutrality, the concept of neutrality that coaches are struggling with. I would say it is a fantastic paper, and it's very critical, but at the same time, very constructive for us to think why we actually struggle with things as they are. And I strongly would recommend that for coaches, for supervisors, and particularly for educationalists.
And what's the paper called? How can people find it?
It's called something. If you just put the Journal of Management Studies, and then neutrality, that is in the title, so it will come up. But the authors are Pauline Fetien and Dima Lewis and Islam, I forgot the second, the surname is Islam. So three authors, Fetien, Lewis and Islam.
Okay, I think that's enough to find it. And maybe we can put it in the show notes.
It will come up, yes.
Wonderful.
And also, just one more thing just to mention. Mm-hmm. I just recently submitted they asked me to write the foreword for the book of Ethics Coaches Handbook.
Oh, yes. I'm publishing a chapter in that.
Yeah. And I wrote the foreword for it. And I also just want to say, I was struggling there with some of the big, big issues just about ethics. And I think it sort of highlights the good things about our field, that we are actually trying to focus on something that is incredibly difficult. Okay, and also not afraid to look at it and see where the holes are in our thinking. And is in terms of recommending my own work, that is a recent one, and I did put a lot of thinking there, so I could suggest people to read it.
Yes, absolutely. And it was really interesting to engage in the editing process, because Wendy Ann Smith and the other editors, they're very clear that they don't want the authors to say, this is how you should be doing it. Mm-hmm. You know, we want to put issues out there and allow coaches to think about that, because ethics really isn't a set of rules or guidelines to follow. It's a set of questions we need to ask ourselves. And the amount of questions that will be in this book is going to be phenomenal. So I love ethics, especially in education environments, because this is the whole range of how people think about it is just there, you know, and it reveals so much about how coaches approach their work.
And can you see, this is what I really like, okay? Because you are actually talking about the problem, but you talk about it in a quite positive way, which is nice. Because I think our field is absolutely full of big puzzles and paradoxes, okay? And you can look at them and say, oh, you have millions of problems. But you can look at them and say, you have a lot of interesting challenges. You have a lot of interesting things to learn, to understand, to reframe, to engage with. And that is the attitude that I would kind of want to finish with.
Awesome. Well, that's great. I cannot imagine any better point to finish. So I just say, Tatiana, thank you so much for your time. I know you're busy with lots of stuff. I found a list of the keynotes that you gave at conferences just from the last couple of years. So please, please keep doing what you do. This is so valuable. Thank you for making time and see you around.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed the episode. To watch these episodes on video, make sure you also check out youtube.com/animascoaching. See you back here soon.